This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello and welcome to The Morning Run on BFM 89.9, the business station. It's Friday, the 24th of March. I'm Melissa Idris. With me this morning, Julian Ng. Good morning, Jules.
Good morning.
6 o'clock now. In the next 4 hours, we've got lots of interviews coming your way. Today on The Breakfast Grill, I'm going to be speaking to Chew Chong Kiat, Group Managing Director of Freight Management Holdings Berhad. They're a listed company and predominantly part of, you know, offering multimodal freight services. So they've got sea, land, rail, tug and barge, which is an interesting one, and a proxy for world trade, essentially, and a trade of the country. But they claim to differentiate themselves from their competitors by saying that they don't outsource their work. So they say that they take on all of the freight forwarding work themselves. So they don't say, okay, they're going to outsource it to third parties.
That's interesting.
It is interesting, but it also begs the question whether this is the best way to do it.
Exactly.
You know? Yeah, I mean, you've got your overheads to think about. There's some synergy to be done, maybe efficiency to be done by outsourcing, financial efficiency to be done by outsourcing. But they say, well, if they do outsource, then they can't control everything. So they're subject to delays and other people's whims and fancies.
So they're touting themselves as some integrated manager, aggregator of these logistic and freight services.
Correct.
Which are very important right now in an age of e-commerce, because e-commerce also outsources a lot of stuff. For example, an online platform that's selling goods may not necessarily have their own warehouses and have those goods in their inventory. So they would need a third-party service provider like freight management company to provide those kind of services.
Exactly.
I'm not sure if there's an economic advantage in doing everything in-house for this company.
I will definitely want to pose that question to him. But also, I mean, you know, yesterday we heard of the launch of the Digital Free Trade Zone, which is set to tap into the potential of the growth of e-commerce into the country. It's a long-term project. But already, freight management is seeing, they want to tap into the e-commerce right now. So what they've done is kind of create a really niche market for themselves. They have a particularly good reputation in third-party logistics for sectors in lubricants, and that's a really difficult sector because you've got to...
It's a slippery sector.
It's a slippery sector. You've got to tick all the checklists for this. High fashion apparel. So apparently, some of the atas brands in Malaysia use them to transport their goods. So all these imported products from, say, the States or from Europe. But while their third-party logistics is doing well, their tug and barge business really suffered. And I think it has to do a lot with the overcapacity in the shipping industry.
Okay. What's that for? I mean, what sector did it serve with
so,
that?
So when you think about big ships that pass through the Straits of Malacca, sometimes the ships are so big and the water is too shallow. So they use tug and barge to navigate the waters, to, I guess, sometimes unload the cargo. However, they saw a $3.5 million loss for their tug and barge business last year. And simply put, I was looking at the numbers, it's just a matter of overcapacity. They've had to drop their rates in this sector because, you know, there's so many other tug and barge boats around. So they just cannot charge the normal prices that they're charging. Quite interesting. I want to see whether they're going to focus on this sector or maybe move into something like rail, which is getting a lot of attention recently from the government. So freight management is on the spotlight for The Breakfast Grill at 8 o'clock. After the grill at 8:30, we take a look at a UN program that will pay Malaysia to keep its forests. Now, last month, we looked at why a carbon trading deal that was pursued by Kelantan was rejected by the Ministry of Natural Resources and Environment. One of the reasons why the federal government rejected it was allegedly that this carbon trading deal would block a national plan to get some climate financing from the UN. There's this program called Reducing Emissions from Forest and Forest Degradation, REDD, and apparently pays developing countries to keep their forests.
Well, that's very interesting. I think that it's also similar to a request from a South American country from a few years ago, I think. I don't remember what the country was, but they were about to embark on a very big project to mine for certain resources in the Amazonian jungle.
Mm-hmm.
And they said that if they were paid not to do it, they would stop doing it. And I don't have the results of what their efforts were, because I saw this on a docu-movie a few years ago. And I don't know what's the update on that. But I think it seems like a pretty good idea, because in the days of the Industrial Revolution, when the West started to pollute the earth with their own industrialization, the emerging markets have been late to the game, and now they're catching up economically. But that catch up is coming at a time with grave environmental concerns.
Right.
So what do they do now? What do these developing countries do now? And I think this payment for environmental idea may not be a bad one.
Yeah, I completely hear you, because it's a monetary incentive not to pollute, right? And we often have that discussion. I remember on the breakfast grill you had with Greenpeace, you asked,
yes,
what are the trade-offs? You know, as a developing country, we want to catch up and we want to industrialize and we want to be a developed nation. But, you know, that the pollution has already been caused by all these other developed nations. So what about developing countries? And I think the UN is trying to give a monetary incentive for developing countries to preserve the environment. We spoke to Dr. Elizabeth Phillip from the Ministry of Natural Resources and Environment, and she explains why the federal government is pursuing the REDD Plus program.
Now the issue is between generating income and conservation. And it's a fine line, because states want money and they need to look for funds to develop. If they want to keep the forest and they don't lock the forest, then they have no revenue. So how do they continue to progress as well as keep the forest? I think REDD Plus is the answer, because they get incentives to keep the forest and they can also develop.
So this is just, I think, a case of the national, so a state program being at odds with the bigger national agenda. And the BF today on Current Affairs, we want to explore the federal government's initiative for forest management and the current environmental issues plaguing the country.
So just an update of what I was talking about earlier. I see there's a headline from September 2015 on how Norway is to complete the $1 billion payment to Brazil for protecting the Amazon. Brazil had more than achieved a goal of reducing the rate of deforestation by 75%, the condition for the payments under the agreement for the 2008 to 2015 protection negotiation of the Amazon forest.
Wow. So Norway is actually paying Brazil this.
Yeah.
Wow. And it's not even like here it's a UN agent, it's a UN program, so a world body, but this is specific. Another state is paying another state.
Exactly. I think Brazil also tried to open this up to the rest of the world, but I think Norway was just one of those countries which responded and not the others. Perhaps it has a lot to do with the amount of money Norway has in the Norway fund, and also the kind of emotional and intellectual commitment Norway has to protecting the environment.
You know, more and more, every time you see these kind of happiness ranking surveys,
yes,
or best place to live surveys, and Norway's always at the top, this is probably one of the reasons why.
Absolutely.
They are global citizens and well aware of, you know, the future of the planet. There you go. We'll be talking about the environment at 8:30 on Current Affairs today. And on The Property Show at 9:30, we look inwards at Kuala Lumpur's aspirations to become a global livable city. So KL is really in its quest to become a global livable city, must balance rapid urbanization with preserving heritage and culture, but at the same time thinking about enhancing real estate value for residents and investors alike. That is a tricky balance.
Very tricky. I think they are competing wants and competing goals. I was listening to a show yesterday on The Bigger Picture. I think I was driving around at time and managed to catch a conversation about how to make cities in Malaysia greener. I think towns in Malaysia greener. And so very interesting statistics. Malaysia has, I think, about 10 cubic meters, not cubic, 10 square meters, not cubic meters, 10 square meters of green space per person, per capita. That's below Singapore's 15. I mean, you would think that Singapore
has more?
Yeah. That you would think that Singapore is a concrete jungle, but apparently Singapore has more green space per person than Malaysia. And even Singapore itself is below other countries. And Singapore is not exactly right there at the desirable and aspirational level.
But Singapore is small, has all these space constraints. I mean, we are blessed with so much land. I'm surprised that we're not using it for more of a green nature.
And if you go, if you went to Singapore, you would be surprised how much green space Singapore has.
Well, if you want to catch the conversation that Julian was talking about, you can download the podcast from our website, bfm.my. It's called Planning a City with Bukit Gasing State Assemblyman Rajiv Rishiakaran. And it talks a little bit about how a master plan is needed now so the public can have a say in what gets built in their neighbourhoods. So if you don't want to get it from our website, the best place to get it is on our app at BFM. You can download that app at the App Store or Google Play. Stream it live. Planning a City with Rajiv Rishiakaran, Bukit Gasing Assemblyman. So let's come back to what's going on in the news cycle, Julian, with the latest on the London attack. We've got news now that the man who is believed to have carried out the London attack in Westminster has been named by the police. He is Khalid Masood. It is not... he is born in Britain, so he's born in Kent, but police don't believe that that is his birth name. So Khalid Masood is probably a name that he adopted later in life. He was shot dead by police, but previously had not been subject to any police investigation. However, he did have a range of previous convictions.
And he's 52 years old, believed to be living in the West Midlands. And this is interesting, Melissa, because yesterday we talked about how perhaps the Islamic State group may be wiped off from the face of Earth. Today, they say that they are behind the attack.
That's right. So, the Islamic State in the Middle East, in Syria and in Mosul, in Iraq, have suffered a series of defeats. So that led people to believe, there's a chance of them retreating, of wiping this terrorist group out completely. However, just, a few days after this attack happened and Islamic State has claimed responsibility for this, they say they were behind the attack. And it's led a lot of security analysts to say that Islamic State is really shifting its focus. It's no longer on the ground war. It's these terror attacks in large cities that, although the number of casualties is a lot lower, the impact of it is a lot bigger because all eyes are then trained on these attacks and they get a lot of publicity over it. You have five men and three women already arrested on suspicion of preparation of these terrorist attacks. In fact, we spoke to Steve Hewitt, who is a security analyst based in Birmingham University, and he told BFM what the current situation in the area is. Okay, we'll be back with the clip from Steve Hewitt, but I want to say that in reading all the commentary over this, the one that stood out for me the most was what I read in The Guardian. The Guardian put out an op-ed yesterday, and I'm just going to quote the last paragraph. "Today's attack has been long anticipated. It is not an act of war. It must not be allowed to divide us one from the other. Terror's purpose is to spread hate and division. The first protection against it must be solidarity." And the hashtag that's going around now in London is hashtag we are not afraid, which is very good, I think.
Yep. The other tweet that actually caught my eye was Donald Trump's. And I think the whole world is up in a furor trying to assess what Trump's intentions are to tweet this out. And he said, "You have got to be kidding me."
Yeah, this is Donald Trump Jr., right? Yeah.
Oh, Jr., sorry.
Yeah, his son. His son has really come under fire for that. What happened was, I saw that too, and it really made me roll my eyes a little bit. Donald Trump Jr. tweeted an article that was written last year in which the London mayor, Sadiq Khan, said that terror vigilance had become part and parcel of life in a global city. So all he did, he didn't read the entire article. All he did was pick that headline and tweeted it out and said, "You've got to be kidding me." And the backlash from that was, well, read the whole article, mm-hmm. because if you did, you would have seen what he said essentially was that that terror threats are part and parcel of living in a big city, but you have to be prepared. You have to support the people who are doing an incredibly hard job, the security services, the police. And he said this like a year ago.
Yeah.
But by tweeting it out, it made it sound like he said it just after the attack, and he was insensitive enough to say
exactly.
it just after.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that having said that a year ago, it's a good thing to say because it's better to be honest about the situation so that you can tackle the problem head on and educate people about the existence of that problem rather than sweeping it under the carpet. So yeah. I think it's good to acknowledge it.
I have to say this was a terrible move on Donald Trump Jr.'s part. It felt like he was using this tragedy for his own political gain, for scoring points against Sadiq Khan, who he has had some tumultuous relationship. I think at one point Donald Trump called him ignorant. No, was it the other way around? I can't remember. So they were quite upset. So London and New York, of course, having a bit of a tussle. But that's one thing that caught our mind. We've got that clip now from Steve Hewitt. We spoke to him. He is a security analyst with Birmingham University.
I'm actually in Birmingham, where they're searching a flat where I think the attacker lived. And I can count about four or five satellite trucks. I can count several police vans. There's a large crowd gathered out sort of looking at what's going on. So Birmingham, in some ways, now is at the center of the story as well.
So that was Scott. Steve Hewitt, a security analyst. We spoke to him, and we will have that podcast to you on our website as well. But also to give you updates into this developing story throughout the morning. It's now 6:17, and we'll be back with more news after this on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Pump It Up by Elvis Costello. Good morning, it's 6:22 right now, Friday the 24th of March. You're listening to The Morning Run with me, Melissa Idris, and Julian Ng this morning. Now, taking a quick look again at the news from overnight in the US, a vote on President Donald Trump's new healthcare bill in the House of Representatives has been delayed. This is a big deal because the president had insisted he would win the numbers to pass it through the lower chamber of Congress.
Big setback.
It is. And he had promised, I think this was a big part of his election campaign, talking about repealing and replacing Obamacare. And now I think some Republicans have abstained from voting and said that they need more time.
I think the Republicans would be worried about the kind of reputation that they would have with their constituents and their voters. And the U.S. market is also just taking a breather from that huge Trump bump that they had since November. And the market's sort of flattening out right now, not exactly flatlining, but not exactly rallying as we've seen in the past few months.
I have to say, Jules, when I read this story, I got the, we were talking a lot in the past couple of days about the importance of this meeting. This is going to be a huge test for Donald Trump to see whether he can repeal Obamacare. But when I read about this, in my mind, I was thinking that there must be some kind of House of Cards stuff going on behind the scenes.
Now, you're thinking about Frank Underwood.
I'm thinking about the whip must be trying to get all the votes ready. So there you go. Just the back of my mind, I was wondering what's happening behind closed doors now. Probably a lot of these political discussions happening. But we'll have to see whether Donald Trump can, in fact, replace Obamacare with Trumpcare, which many Republicans are hesitant about because they feel it doesn't go far enough.
Yeah. But, you know, Melissa, interestingly, Malaysia is also toying around with the idea of a different kind, but similar in the same vein, a kind of employment insurance. In America, they're considering healthcare insurance. Mm-hmm. But Putrajaya is talking about an employment insurance.
Yeah, so yesterday, this is interesting, Prime Minister Dato' Sri Najib Razak announced that the federal government wants to implement a proposed employment insurance scheme, this EIS, which will affect about 6.5 million private sector workers. They want to implement this starting January next year. And Hopefully, they say the first payment can be made by January 2016 for any kind of unemployed.
January 2019.
So start next year in 2018, and then payment, the first payment could be made by January 2019. Mm-hmm. And the idea essentially is to, if you lose your job, to be able to give you some kind of financial help while you're looking, and some kind of upskilling program to allow you to upskill and find a new job.
Yeah, I think I haven't looked at the full details of this idea, but I think that the concept is quite a desirable one, because you really need to provide some kind of a social safety net to people who get laid off from their jobs. But of course, as always, the devil is in the details.
Right.
And right now, I think the Employers Association and the industry people are against this. But we have been talking about being a high income status nation, and what that means for all of us. And what it means is that if you watch a lot of reality TV and somebody is down and out on the streets, a reality TV sentiment would dictate that you want to help a brother or a sister out, right?
Yes.
So you can't let them fall by the wayside. And the reaction of the employers would be something that's natural as well. But if you were to try to create a social safety net, you would need to fund that. And it's either an insurance scheme or to tax the employers. Now, which would the employers want?
Yeah, so, okay. So the employers, as you said, are opposed to this scheme. The idea is that it's going to be funded by a contribution from both the employers and the employees. So the government doesn't really have a contribution in this. And when you say social safety net, I think of the government's role in providing some kind of safety net, not employers and taxing even more workers and private sector workers like you and I, for instance. And the reason why they are so resistant to this, they say that, well, you're taxing, you know, you're collecting from everyone, but it will only benefit the few that will be unemployed. So their rationale is, well, it's not really our duty to do that. We're already providing them a compensation package when they are retrenched, right? Whose responsibility is it to provide this social safety net?
Well, that is exactly the situation in high tax rate countries like the Scandinavian countries and, you know, countries like Australia. People there are somewhat willing to pay the taxes because they know that they can get the benefits out of it. It is that really high government involvement, low government involvement debate,
yeah,
that we are having
technically
now.
Technically Republican and Democrats, right?
Exactly. And now, really, at the heart of the matter is we're going back to this trust deficit that exists with the government. Should the government, are they coming from more of a moral high ground to ask people to fund this kind of situation? Or should the government look into the mirror and say whether they can improve things on their side, you know? Curbing corruption is one of those things. So it's a very existential question right now for
it
the
is.
Government.
Yeah, and I can't believe it's being reflected in something like this, right? Such an existential question, but, you know, reflected in the backlash that we're seeing from the EIS, the employers, the employees insurance scheme. Is it employers or employees? Let me just check. Employment insurance scheme.
That means it would benefit the employees, but somebody has to pay for it.
I also want to stay on this topic of the economy, because yesterday Bank Negara released its 2016 Financial Stability and Payment System report. And there were some really interesting findings within that report. Bank Negara said that the largest share of debt, about 40%, is owned by individuals in the top 20 income group that earned about more than 8,000 ringgit a month. So this, in a way, they're trying to say, well, don't worry so much about the high household to debt ratio that we're seeing, because apparently most of the debt is being held by the top 20%. They can afford to hold that much debt, because if it's the lower band, then they will have narrower margins buffer for in case something goes wrong.
Now, the figure that was put forward is very interesting, 8,000 ringgit a month. And I don't think this is a figure that comforts me, because 8,000, while they're defined as being high income, is not a lot of money to me. And you can get into a lot of trouble with attracting a lot of debt with that 8,000 ringgit.
Yeah. You know, I mean, to be... to have them say that the top 20% income group is 8,000 ringgit a month is really quite startling to me, because they say the bottom 40 income group earns less than 3,500 ringgit a month. I don't know. I mean, for me, it's really quite disturbing still that so much of the debt is concentrated within the 8,000 ringgit bracket already. Apparently, most of the debt is going through the purchase of houses. And then you've got debt for vehicle purchases and personal use. So essentially, it's your house, your car, and your credit card debt, right? And that's the bulk of your debt.
And I think that property is a good debt, so that alleviates the situation a little bit.
Okay, it's time now for the first news bulletin of the day. We've got Lynn Mark standing by with the news bulletin on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Rock the Casbah by The Clash. You're listening to The Morning Run. I'm Melissa Idris with Julian Ng. 6:40 on the clock right now. And Julian, what is the time economy? You told me about this yesterday, but I feel like I need you to explain it, because the idea is the GDP, the country's gross domestic product, is not the best measure of a country's growth or productivity.
So the GDP can only measure whatever transactions or activities that take place that have a ringgit or dollar value to it. But what if you are a caregiver? What if you are a parent taking care of your children? What if you have taken time off to take care of the elderly and disabled? Now, these are activities that are very valuable and very crucial to the economy, and yet understated, and in fact not stated at all in those GDP numbers. So these guys, who are huge support to the nation, are not acknowledged through a GDP number. And I think if you added up the value of this time into the GDP, you would probably have a much higher value. If those services are being paid for or being assigned a dollar value, you probably have a much higher number for the GDP. So this proposal that has been put forward by the Institute of Policy, full name of the institution, Institute of Policy Studies in Singapore, that's under the auspices of the National University of Singapore, they are proposing a sort of time bank for caregivers, social workers, people who essentially go out there and help one another without an expectation of payment. That time will be credited back into an account that will be created for them, so that they can draw on the time when they need some help from their fellow human beings.
So other people would repay their services through this time bank. You know, when you were telling me about this story, I was reminded of an episode of Planet Money that I had listened to from NPR. The way they explained it was really simple. Say we had kids, Julia, not together, but say you... Let me rephrase that. Say you
that would be a messy affair.
Had our families and children, and I took care of your kids and you took care of my kids, and we paid each other for that service. That service will be counted under the GDP. But if you took care of your own kid and I took care of my own kid, that service is not counted under GDP, which is a very simple idea, but it's completely true about how we calculate gross domestic product.
Exactly. And those services, even though they are unaccounted from a dollar value, is so valuable to the economy. And the writer has suggested a few advantages if a time bank was started. And in fact, I think Singapore is trying to come up with an action plan to start this time bank. And as we know, countries and nations all over the world have the problem of an aging society. Mm. How do you create an environment where the younger and more abled members of that society take care of their elderly? And this is something that is really important. So three advantages are put forward when you come up with this concept of time bank. First is that it would permit a redefinition of the concept of productivity, which is so important for the economy when you include things that don't have dollar value but are very valuable to society. Second, It brings recognition and focus to how we use our time and help us to break out of that 9-to-5 workday mindset,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes.
And thirdly, the economy tends to undervalue the elderly, and this will bring the kind of value and contribution of the elderly that who have made and brought a lot of value to the economy and to society.
You know, I completely agree with you. I hear you when we need to rethink how we calculate productivity, right? What goes into you know, calculating that figure. Everyone's so fixated on the figure, Malaysia's GDP, what's China's GDP, what's the US's GDP. It's as though the economy of a country can be condensed into a percentage, into one figure. And I have to say, though, it's a little antiquated, because if you look at the GDP, it came up in the 1920s, 1930s, when the Great Depression hit, and the U.S. government needed to explain to people why was it that you felt like your family was out of work, that you couldn't put food on the table. They needed a figure to explain it.
Okay.
And all these years, it's turned into this fixation of that one figure. I think we've simplified it to the point where we think an economy is represented by one figure. But in fact, if you look at the way GDP figures are calculated, just relooking that methodology can shift a country's GDP. The US a couple of years ago relooked at the way they were calculating GDP, and then suddenly the GDP jumped several basis points. And then in Italy and in the UK, they decided to include drugs and prostitution into the calculation of GDP. And then that was a huge cry out there, because they said, well, this is part of the economy. So in fact, just by calculating the drug and prostitution into the GDP, it lifted Italy out of a recession. So it was such a huge jump in their GDP figures. I have to say, though, that I love the idea of this, but I wonder whether, because we've had decades of fixating on this figure and the way it's been calculated, that this could work in a wider sense, having, mm-hmm. say, a time bank, relooking the 9-to-5, relooking productivity, relooking the contribution of the elderly.
Yeah, I think that the fixation on a GDP number is also causing a lot of stresses to the country, to people, to the economy. It's also miscalculating the kind of levels of happiness that can be achieved as a result of GDP. And they're coming up with all sorts of happiness index these days.
Yeah, Norway's always at the top of that list.
But it causes a lot of stress, because when you motivate society to eke out a few percentage points at small numbers of GDP growth, society is very stressed out. And the question that's being asked here is that, are there other things that are more important than GDP growth? For example, taking care of our elderly, right? That's something that's valuable to society and not captured by GDP. So I think it's a good thing to move away from this over-focus on GDP.
Yeah, speaking about, you know, when you told me about the elderly and how we are not valuing the contributions, I was reminded of a story that I read in Japan. Because they have such an aging population, they're creating something like the time bank that you spoke of, Julian, where they say you're capable of cooking or doing some parts, some chores or some labor of service. You can do that and bank it. So, for instance, go over to another elderly person's house and cook for them or buy groceries for them. And then that's part of your time bank. So someone else who, say, can do gardening for you will do that for you, or pick up your kids from your grandkids from school, or take care of your grandkids. So it's a lovely community taking care of each other. But it's not calculated. It's not being seen as something that's worthy of putting monetary value on.
Yeah, I think that those kind of problems, those kind of kinks that can be very easily addressed by technology. We know that fintech is such a buzzword today. Mm. Perhaps technology can come in to address some of these accounting issues of helping out other people. But I don't know whether that is a means to an end or the end itself.
Right.
I mean, people would then, some crazy ambitious people would then try to rake up, you know, credits and try to get shout at the top of the mountain that they go out there to help people, right? Perhaps this is not what
it's
we also want.
Different purpose, yeah.
I think it it does, in a way, accounting for this kind of thing, while it gives recognition to people, but if it's overdone, it also ticks away that help, sincere help that you give to other people.
It's coming up to 6:50 right now. We've got the news in about 10 minutes or so. And after that, Market Watch with a look at global markets. But first, here's Beck with The New Pollution on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.